Okay, it's musical o'clock.
Why?
Because we're doing a musical
why
today.
Why would you say? You didn't say dinosaur o'clock last week.
I should have.
Are we going to say ma o'clock when we do ma next one?
Yes, actually, yes. I'm Aaron.
I'm Tom.
This is Baby's First Watch List, the podcast covering a legit classic this week.
Yeah, we do a legit classic every now and then.
Yeah, this is from 1965.
Yeah.
It's 1965's The Sound of Music.
59 years. No. Wow. Yeah, 59 years. Almost 60 years old.
That is wild.
I actually thought it was older because it was a World War II movie. So
yeah,
I was like,
Julie Andrews is still doing the dang thing.
Still doing Aquaman.
Yeah. Just saying no to the Mary Poppins remake so she could be an Aquaman.
Yeah, she's doing the Princess Diaries sequel, isn't she?
I don't know. Is she?
Yeah, I think so.
Queen.
I just saw
literally.
That. I just saw that Anne Hathaway said it's going well, so I assume that.
Hey, whatever. I'll take it. So this musical was directed by Robert Wise. I did not recognize. I may have recognized his name, but I didn't know who he was. Turns out, he had won Best Picture and Best Director for West Side Story.
Yeah.
Which, I mean,
I knew they wanted a musical director for this.
When you're a jet, you're a jet all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day.
Yeah. After they got William Wyler on board, who, if you don't know William Wyler, he is the most nominated director of all time in Oscars history. He did like Ben-Hur. He did like a million things. All the old ones you didn't see. He is great. He didn't work out for this movie.
No.
Which is probably a good thing because it might have been a lot different.
Yeah. And so Robert Wise also, interestingly, was nominated for Best Editing for Citizen Kane.
Oh, yeah, I knew that. That's where I knew his name, yes.
Okay, King. Like, that is, like, so crazy, especially because, like, Citizen Kane was so influential, and the editing was part of that.
The editing is, like, one of the most revered things about
Citizen Kane. Uh-huh, it's amazing. So, honestly, it totally makes sense, though, the West Side Story connection. What's also kind of interesting is both West Side Story and Sound of Music, when I was watching both of those movies, I was like, I know every single song from these movies. Like, it's just, they're in the classic American song catalog. So this guy, Robert Wise, he also was the president of the Directors Guild of America for 4 years in the 70s. And then he was president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences from 1985 to 1988.
He's big in the Oscar Wars book.
I mean, holy cannolis. Also, please excuse my stuffed nose. There's a lot of Edelweiss going on.
Yeah, exactly.
Here. We got the allergy season starting. So this movie was written by Ernest Lehman. So he is 6 times nominated for screenplays and, you know, best picture, all that kind of stuff.
This is really a who's who crew.
Yeah. So he was involved in Sabrina, North by Northwest, West Side Story, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Hello Dolly, all these classics. The movie was adapted from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, which was adapted from Maria von Trapp's The Story of the Trapp Family Singers, which was her kind of memoir. I did not know this. The film rights from Maria von Trapp's book were purchased for only $9,000 in West Germany. And then that became a movie called The Trapp Family.
Yes.
And that movie ended up becoming one of the most successful movies in 1950s Germany.
Yeah. Are you going to talk about the other one?
No, really.
There's another one.
Oh, the sequel. Yeah. There was a sequel too.
The Trapp Family Goes to America or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Those movies are far more popular in Austria and Germany than this one is.
Mm-hmm.
In part because, Germany, I know, censored this movie. Because right. of all the Nazi imagery, and it was like 20 years after everything had happened, so this was not really widely shown in Germany.
Well, and I know that like Salzburg didn't want a lot of it filmed there because of the flags and stuff like that. So they used like old footage.
But I read that when they used the old footage, it showed the Salzburg officials like cozying up with the Nazi officials. So they were very like, wait a minute, we probably shouldn't use all this either.
Right. So the original Broadway show starred Mary Martin. So do you know who Mary Martin is?
No clue.
I only like my sister and my 2 cousins will get this. We, when Aunt Mary watched us, we got to pick a movie, you know, oh, it's Aaron's turn to pick a movie, whatever. I would like always pick the live action Broadway showing of Peter Pan and Mary Martin played Peter Pan.
Wow.
Yeah. And so
there she is, the queen.
The queen. So when I saw Mary Martin played Maria Von Trapp, I was like, yeah, that tracks.
You think Peter Pan could play Maria Von Trapp?
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
So the original Broadway show won 5 Tonys, including Best Musical, after it opened in 1959. And then those film rights were then bought for $1.25 million.
Yeah.
A little bit more than the $9,000 that Maria Von Trapp got. Cinematographer Ted McCord, which the cinematography was so gorgeous in this movie.
Honestly, one of the things I was most, not surprised at, but I didn't expect.
Yeah. So beautiful. He was a 3-time nominee, but honestly, like all the other movies he was nominated for, I did not know.
It's like eyes glazing over,
like,
in your head.
Super old black and white stuff. Editor William Reynolds was nominated for 7 editing Oscars. He won 2. Some of the other movies that he edited were The Godfather and The Sting.
He was a big new Hollywood guy.
Mm-hmm. He also executive produced like 2 of the biggest box office bombs in history.
Incredible.
Ishtar and Heaven's Gate. So
Heaven's Gate is the one by the guy who did The Deer Hunter, right?
I think so.
Michael Cimino.
Possibly.
And it was like, I think Heaven's Gate, yeah, it starred Kris Kristofferson and Christopher Walken. That movie is seen as the movie that ended the new Hollywood era because it was such a bomb.
And Ishtar, I think, was Aline May.
It was, who did like Mikey and Nikki, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
So yeah, I find that super fascinating that he was involved in like some of the best movies of all time, best received movies of all time, and then these two movies that were just like absolutely decimated at the box office.
Also, before we get too far into this, I wanted to mention this at the top. We have a pretty big announcement on the show coming in the next couple of days, so just stay tuned for that. Follow us on Instagram too. We're gonna put it up there. We're gonna give you all the details. It's good.
I think it's good.
It's a good change.
Yeah.
So we are. I just wanted to get that out there now. So yeah, we can get back to what we were talking about.
Okay, good, because we're getting to the good stuff now. The movie star Julie Andrews. What do you know Julie Andrews from?
Me?
Yeah.
I mean, Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
And Princess Diaries.
Yeah. For me, it's Princess Diaries off the top because...
You grew up.
I grew up.
I didn't grow up with either of them, really.
I was 10 years old when it came out. So she was always...
I was 40. No, I just didn't really watch it.
Oh my God. I was always a Queen Clarice gal. And then, Mary Poppins, of course. And Sound of Music. I mean, she's such a queen.
She was excellent in this movie.
Excellent. Like, truly wonderful. Just beautiful. And then, of course, it also...
What about Thoroughly Modern Millie?
The other thing I think of her is Victor Victoria.
Oh, okay. Shrek 2.
Oh, yeah. And Shrek 2. She's the Fiona's mom.
Oh, man. Wait a minute. Here's what she's been in since 2001. She did Princess Diaries, then she did a movie called Unconditional Love, where she was a cameo playing herself. Then she did Princess Diaries 2, then she did Shrek 2.
Royal Engagement.
Shrek 2, Shrek the 3rd, she was the narrator in Enchanted.
Yeah.
Tooth Fairy, Shrek Forever After, Despicable Me, Despicable Me 3,
yeah, she's
Aquaman, The King's Daughter, where she was the narrator, which is like a fantasy movie, and Minions the Rise of Gru.
She also narrated Bridgerton.
That's her last like 25 years of movies.
Yeah.
How ridiculous is that?
Yeah, she's amazing.
That's great. I mean, it's just like, it's like she's getting that money. Good for you, Julie.
As she should.
Good for you, Julie.
And the movie also stars Christopher Plummer, who
hated filming this movie.
Who hated it, yeah. But we don't really know Christopher Plummer from that much. You just read his memoir.
I read his memoir. He was much more of a stage actor than a movie actor. But he did a ton of movies, too.
And we know him from Beginners.
Beginners, Knives Out.
Knives Out, of course.
All the Money in the World. His more recent stuff.
His more recent stuff, yeah. Beginners is definitely a must-watch for his performance alone.
He won the Oscar for it, right?
He was, I think, the oldest... he was the oldest dude to win, right?
I think you're right. He's the only Canadian to have the Triple Crown of Acting.
Wow.
Academy Award, Emmy, and Tony.
That's so cool. And he passed away just a couple years ago.
Inside Man he was in. Remember, he was like the rich guy?
Yep.
Girl with a Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah, you're right.
So he was in so much stuff, even later on in his life, in his career. He had that like third act after Beginners.
Yeah, and I mean, most people have seen Knives Out.
Yeah,
where he's the patriarch of the family, the victim.
Yeah.
Which is not a big spoiler. That's
Harlan Thrombey.
Yes. And yeah, he was in All the Money in the Didn't he get nominated for that?
Well, Kevin Spacey was supposed to be in it.
Yeah.
And then he got replaced by Plummer, and then Plummer got nominated for it.
Yeah. For like, I mean, we watched that movie. It was just okay.
Yeah. He was Michelle Williams' dad, wasn't he, or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. So And he was good in this too. I love Christopher Plummer.
Yeah.
He's awesome. But Beginners is a must watch. Filming happened in both LA and Salzburg, and you can see like the Salzburg sites are just incredible.
This is a good way to justify putting a play or a musical on film, because with a musical you can only get so much of that.
Yep.
But with a movie you can go literally to the location.
Yep.
And film like the beautiful Alps, you know.
Yeah. It makes me want to go to Austria.
Yeah, totally.
Which
also is partially why the Austrians don't like it, because it brought so much
annoying
American
singing.
Western tourism.
The movie was like an instant commercial success. It is I was going through some of this stuff and I was like, holy cow, it is considered one of the most successful movies of all time. It was the highest grossing film of 1965. A lot of that is because of repeat watching. So this fact is crazy. In some U.S. cities, more tickets to The Sound of Music were sold than people living in that city. So people went to see it a lot, which for a really long movie, that's pretty impressive.
That was almost the standard at that time, though.
That is true. It, like nowadays, I'm oh my God, it's how long? But back then, there were a lot of movies that were long. And this one had an intermission.
Yeah.
Which there was the whole controversy with Killers of the Flower Moon this year, which you can listen to our episode. We talk about it.
Yep.
How a couple of theaters were actually putting in an intermission. And Thelma, what?
Schoonmaker.
Yeah, she got mad, the editor. And Scorsese wasn't happy either. And they ended up getting rid of the intermission at those places. It was the highest grossing film of all time in the late 60s.
Insane.
It got that.
Insane to think that this, not that there's anything wrong with this movie, but that this was the highest grossing of all time.
Do you want to guess what movie it beat, which had the record for quite some time?
Quite some time. I don't know.
Gone with the Wind.
Gone.
Another long one with an intermission.
Duh.
And Sound of Music stayed the highest grossing film of all time to this day. No, I'm just kidding. For 2.5 decades. I think it was 24 years. With inflation, it's still in the top 10 highest grossing films of all time, according to Wikipedia. So it could be different now because so many movies now just like make so much money. And the soundtrack. I did not know the soundtrack hit like this. The soundtrack reached number one on the Billboard charts. It stayed in the top 10 for 109 weeks. It was actually the second best-selling album of the decade in the UK in the 60s. In the 60s.
Right.
And in 2015, Billboard named The Sound of Music soundtrack as the second best album of all time.
Wow. What was number one? Thriller?
I don't know, but I'm impressed. Wait, you got to look that up.
Keep going. Keep going. I'll find it.
So The Sound of Music actually had kind of a mixed critical response at first. A lot of critics said that it was too sweet and saccharine.
One of those critics included Christopher Plummer.
Mm. but it cleaned up at the Oscars, I gotta say.
Well, the Oscars are known for rewarding some of those types of movies.
That is true. With 9 nominations and 5 wins, the nominations included Best Actress for Julie Andrews, Supporting Actress for the Pauline Wood, I think her name was, who played Mother Abbess. I want to say Abscess, but it's not that.
No, I think it's Abbess.
Abbess.
Number one. Okay, just circling back.
Am I right that number two is Sound of Music?
Number two is The Sound of Music. Number one is Adele, 21.
So strange.
Number three is Thriller. Number four is Taylor Swift, Fearless. Number five is Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA.
That is so fascinating.
What a strange top five.
Yes. It was also nominated for Art Direction Color, Cinematography Color, Costume Design Color. It won Best Picture, Best Director, Film Editing, Scoring, and Sound.
There's a lot to like about this movie.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Since the movie came out, and as the decades have kind of gone on, it's been in top 10 lists everywhere, especially for musicals.
Yeah.
It is extremely popular even to this day. We have friends who love The Sound of Music. They did one of those like Sound of Music Live kind of things on TV with Carrie Underwood in the lead role.
Okay.
There's a very popular sing-along version that is played in theaters, which I would go see. I've never been to one of those. I would love to go see Grease sing-along. I would do High School Musical sing-along. I'd do all of them. And then if you go on Disney Plus, like some of them have a sing-along version.
That is true.
Pretty fun. Of course, it is preserved by the Library of Congress. I think it was in 2001. for being culturally and significant.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. So there was so much more to The Sound of Music.
Yeah.
That I did not go into.
We aren't getting into the, we aren't getting everything in, you know, 50 minutes or whatever.
Nah.
But we will get to the taglines.
Oh, yeah. Isn't it like the most beautiful sound you've ever heard?
One of them is radiance that fills the screen and warms the heart.
Oh, that's sweet.
That that feels like one that's the original.
That also feels accurate to me.
Because like the re-releases will just take the quote and, you know.
Yeah.
The second one, there was a lot. I took three. The more you see it, the more it becomes one of your favorite things.
I mean, it's cute.
And then finally, the hills fill my heart with the sound of music. That's a that's such a strangely phrased one. Like the poster's talking to me.
Yeah, it's the poster's favorite. What do you want?
Yeah, and then just a brief synopsis. A young novice played by Julie Andrews is sent by her convent in 1930s Austria to become a governess to the seven children of a widowed naval officer played by Christopher Plummer.
Very handsome Christopher Plummer.
Very handsome, very inebriated Christopher Plummer.
Yeah, which you don't know that in the movie.
No. You can't tell. Unless you can, but I couldn't tell. I just want to start by saying I have kind of a... We've talked about this before. I have kind of a weird thing with musicals where sometimes they take me out of focus when they sort of switch back and forth between like singing and people just bursting out into song.
You say that, but we've watched a lot of musicals over the years and you've enjoyed quite a few of them.
I have, but it doesn't mean that like they're gonna kill for me, you know?
Just like not everything can be The Greatest Showman.
Exactly. Not everything can be the greatest. This is not The Greatest Showman. Never reaches those heights. No. So starting this one with The Sound of Music, the song helped me because
You're in it.
There's no context. She's just singing. She's singing on a mountain, like, you know,
on a mountaintop with what would have been a drone.
Right, exactly. Would have been put in post if it was Irish Wish. But
like everything else.
So I really liked starting with that because it takes people like me who are dumb and can't suspend disbelief for musicals, and spoon feeds us. Mm-hmm. I also, from like a writing perspective, I liked seeing her sort of freed out in the sun, kind of like hanging out there and doing something that she loves and that she feels, you know, comfortable doing. And then right after the credits, it's like it cuts to the nuns like somberly singing in a dark room. And it's like they're all like stuffed up and she doesn't show up. She's late.
Yep.
So it's really strong juxtaposition like right off the bat. Yeah. Being like, this is what she loves to do. This is what she's like, thinks she wants to do, but is not necessarily really where she's going to end
right
up. And right off the bat, like kind of subtly, like puts that into her character right away. Mm-hmm. But what did you think about the song Maria, which is the nun's diss track on her? Essentially, they kind of go back and forth. It's almost like a battle rap situation.
I really like it because it's a great way to show characterization
of Maria.
Without having it be super on the nose. You know what I mean? Without like telling us. Even though they do tell us.
They do, but they're telling each other.
Yeah, it's a really smart way to do it.
And it's on purpose. There's no... It suits the narrative.
And it's also... They're talking about things that she does that would clearly not be suitable for the convent and what the people expect in that situation, but is not necessarily bad things for like, we're not going to be like, oh, Maria's kind of like crazy. Like, it's not like that. Like, oh, Maria's the villain.
Well, it's funny you say that because the real Maria Von Trapp claimed that this movie toned down her behavior and that she said, I was way worse than this.
Okay. Well, and when they're saying this stuff, you're like, oh, that's not too bad. But you can understand
they call
why.
Her a demon.
Yeah, they're joking.
They also call her a Flibberty Gibbet.
Wow. Now that distress goes hard. So I really liked it. And it's fun to give the nuns a song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like kind of ironic. And
yeah, it's cute. You know,
yeah, no. It's good. So do you think it was the right call for them to let her go temporarily? Or should it have been like, listen, you got to stay or you got to go?
Oh, yeah. This is so movie magic. I'm sorry.
Right.
I know apparently it's based on a true story. I don't know if this part is true, but... Like, that would never happen.
They can't be, like, unless it was, like, a common practice. We're like, all right, we'll send you on this mission, kind of, for a little while, and then you come back.
Although, I will say, nowadays, maybe they would do something like that, because, let's face it, they probably don't have overflowing applications for nuns in 2024. So maybe they would do that if someone's, you know, they need a little bit extra time. Here, go off, do whatever. They wouldn't necessarily send her to be a governess, but come back and see if it works for you. You know, kind of like how the Amish do it, where you, when you turn 18, you can go off into the world for a little bit. And if you, and then when you come back, you're like, okay, you saw what was out there. You still want to, you're good. Okay.
Right. Well, I think that the thing here is that they know that she's good. Like even in, even throughout Maria, like especially Mother Abbess, like knows, like
she's a good heart.
She's good hearted. So maybe it's like, we don't want to let her go, but she also can't be doing this.
Yeah, she can't be late every day.
She can't be late constantly. She can't be, you can't be a flibberty gippet and be a nun at this convent.
You just can't.
You got to unflibber your gippet, and you have to do that by being a governess at
Christopher Plummer's fancy mansion.
The Von Trapp freaking mansion.
Yeah.
That he is. So I love that he's already playing a retired military veteran.
Yeah, he's like in his 30s.
I feel like he's played a retired person in every single movie he's ever been in.
Goals.
He's only like 36 here. During filming, though, so he's not like old. It's just like, okay, he was in the war and now he's back. And what they don't tell you is that he, in real life, the captain is not like, we were like, okay, why is he so rich?
Yeah,
like why is he in this massive mansion? And it's because in real life he was married to his you know, former wife who had died, was the, I think, the granddaughter of the guy who invented the torpedo, like the submarine torpedo.
That is so Gretchen Wiener's coded.
He literally, she's literally. So he's got all that inheritance money.
Yeah.
And he has parlayed that into a very nice home.
Yeah, it's so beautiful.
And also very nice rich friends.
Yeah.
Who we meet later on.
He does have rich friends and a rich girlfriend.
I just wanted to sort of elaborate on here. Like Christopher Plummer. I read his memoir. It's called
In Spite of Myself.
In Spite of Myself, which
is
like
a great title.
The perfect title for his like wry, dry sense of humor book. And
he does not give off Canadian to me.
No, he's British.
Right? Even if he is Canadian, which he is Canadian, he was like, Canadian.
He's
but
like Canadian royalty. Like he's like connected with like.
Yeah. Oh, if you look on his Wikipedia page and the like relatives, like Nepo baby.
Literally. he really did not like working on this movie. He doesn't really go into it too much in the book because he's nice and he talks really great about Julie Andrews.
Yeah.
He talks more in the book about how he was drunk all the time and how he was the problem.
Right.
But if you look at some of his interviews, he talked about, he called it the sound of mucus. He called it S&M.
Oh, Christopher.
He likened working with Julie Andrews to being hit over the head with a big Valentine's Day card every day.
Oh my goodness.
But him and Julie Andrews, both of them have said that they remain close friends like forever.
Right.
And
they work together later on.
Well, Julie Andrews also said that for this movie in general, like he was super cynical and his cynicism helped the Von Trapp character.
That works for the movie.
It kept him from being too sentimental and it made his sort of later moments, like when he sings Edelweiss, like it makes like, that be like a really important moment.
And they fall in love.
And a really good moment. Also, very little background information apparently was there about the captain. Like the real guy.
Yeah.
So he went to the Salzburg Mountains with an interpreter and they found Georg's nephew and they asked him what like the real guy was like. And he was like, this is the most boring guy in the entire world. Like he wasn't stern. He wasn't like that character at all.
He was just chill.
He was just the most boring guy in the world.
That's really funny.
Yeah. But yeah, no, for real here though, like in the house, the cinematography is on point.
Beautiful.
Like the way that they use the shadows.
Yeah, I was gonna say the shadow.
Like when she's standing on the stairs looking at him, like it's awesome and it just feels so grandiose. Mm-hmm. When we have seven kids, we should have them all stand in the line and say their names.
We?
What do you think about the set? What do you think about the kids?
I mean, I don't understand. I mean, it's based on a true story. So there were a lot of kids, although Liesl was a made up.
Listen, we're talking character. We just covered the Iron Claw not too long ago. So we're differentiating characters from real
life.
Yeah,
of course.
Because there was fewer brothers in the Iron Claw than in real life.
I don't really understand most movies and TV shows that have a significant amount of kids in it because it's like, how am I supposed to get to know all these people?
Yeah.
I didn't know the difference between any of these kids.
They focus on a couple of them.
Liesl.
Yeah.
Who's the oldest?
Kurt. Right? Wasn't
they didn't really
Kurt?
Focus on Kurt.
No,
he
but
was
I remember
just one
name.
Of the two boys.
Friedrich.
The other boy.
He said, "I'm Friedrich. I'm 14. I'm impossible."
Yes. I thought that they were precocious. I think, you know, their bad behavior now would make them stars, like a star students.
Yeah, like the youngest girl, like refusing to talk for like 5 minutes.
Like, okay. Like, you know, oh, they're incorrigible.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, they like made one prank at her. Like, well, that's not a big deal.
Well, I think the point is like that they're not bad. It's like he's just keeping them in line like this. And like, they're fine. Like, why are you doing this to them? Let them like be themselves.
Well, and I think part of the thing too is like, yeah, okay, some of the governesses maybe, because the whole thing is like they've gone through like a billion
governesses,
nannies.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, maybe they're part of the problem. But honestly, how many of them left because of Georg?
Yeah, probably.
Because of Christopher Plummer's character. Yeah. Like, probably more than one.
So amongst kids at the time who, I guess, auditioned to play one of the Von Trapp kids, yeah. Kurt Russell.
I know Mia Farrow was one of them, right?
Mia Farrow, Richard Dreyfuss, Veronica Cartwright, the four eldest Osmond brothers.
And somehow they still managed to pick all characters that, like, are all actors that didn't end up doing much.
Yeah, yeah. For the role of Liesel, Liza Minnelli, Patty Duke, Mia Farrow, Kim Darby, Leslie Ann Warren, and Sharon Tate all auditioned or screen tested.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is weird to me that this is an American movie.
Yeah.
Just because it's like, it takes place in Austria, and the leads are not American, yeah. And it's interesting.
Well, it's one of those things where it's like, why do they all have like British accents?
Yeah.
Like they're,
yeah, right?
They're all in Austria. Yeah. Why they would just be speaking Austrian.
There's so many movies like that.
Yeah. I that did go through my head during this movie, but whatever, it's fine. It's not supposed to be that type of movie, I'm okay with it. Then Liesel has the 16 going on 17 with Rolf. We were like, she was like fraternizing with him, and she like sneaks out from dinner, and she like goes out to
the
talk
gazebo.
To him. And we were like, is this guy a Nazi?
Yeah, and
it turns out he is.
He is.
Red flag.
Yeah, big red flag. Maybe that's a hard no.
One of the biggest red flags.
Yeah,
If not the biggest red flag. We were like this, and we were like, these characters are cosplaying teenagers. Like,
they're so old, and they were.
Yeah, they were like 23 and something like that. I was like, they do the song. Apparently, she did this on like a broken ankle or something.
Wow.
Because she had hurt herself, and she like fell through one of the glass panes. And then like a few days later, like they reshot it later on. And she said that because they digitally removed it in the DVD release and they hid it when they were doing it before that.
Yeah.
People don't believe her when she says that.
That's really funny.
Yeah. And then, so they finished the song and then I wrote, Rolf grabs a smooch and then sprints off into the night like the groundskeeper from Get Out.
It's so funny.
He just sprints off like into the abyss. What are your thoughts on My Favorite Things? Which of course like they reprise throughout the movie, and it's like in the little overtures, like in the opening credits. It's like that's like the one that they were pushing to be the big song.
Well, Ariana Grande did a little song.
Yeah.
Like it. I love it. I love these songs. I know that they're all kind of, it's weird because they're all sort of similar.
This is the exact type of musical soundtrack that I don't like.
Yeah, but every song's a hit.
Every song is famous, and I like them.
Well, this actually brings me to my first question, which is like, what is your favorite, and maybe we could talk about least favorite song in this movie. There's a couple that are kind of, there's like two near the end that I didn't really know, and it turns out that those are the two that were written for the movie. But I want to know, what are any that you like, either is your favorite or ones that you just actually did not enjoy?
I think Do Re Mi is kind of stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's fun.
I get the point of it. She's like teaching them to sort of like hit certain pitches.
Let's
and do
go,
all
children.
and that's sort of their like bonding song after My Favorite Things.
And they're going through the sights of Salzburg, which is cool.
Yeah, which it's a fun scene.
Yeah.
But like if I'm just like, all right, I'm throwing on shuffle, like Do Re Mi pops up, skip.
Yeah.
But I will say that my favorites in the context of the movie, I think my favorite is Edelweiss.
That's my favorite.
Just the way that it comes in and how like important it is to the captain. And then you get a second of Maria's kind of singing it too. I think
the kiddos sing a little bit.
I think that's the best one, but
that's also the one I learned on piano.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's my favorite song that I ever did for a piano concert.
Wow.
Edelweiss.
That's a high bar.
And it, yeah, C is for cookie. I also did one year.
My
favorite, did Kaylee do it? I don't remember.
My favorite things is probably the one that would get stuck in my head the most.
These are a few. When the dog bites. Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. When the bee stings.
Yeah. Sound of Music, of course, is great. Climb Every Mountain is sweet.
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah. And that one's got, you know, the Mother Superior character singing it. So that's kind of sweet. What else is there? There's lots. What about 16 going on 17?
It's kind of dopey.
It is a little bit.
It's dinky.
Ding, 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 ding. Yeah, that is true.
And also, I don't like either of those characters. So
yeah, honestly, I was like, Liesl, you need to stop. Like, you're 16. Like, stop wearing the matching outfits, but also wanting to date this very questionable fellow. Like,
yeah,
no.
Yeah, no. So those aren't my favorites. Maria's good. Like we talked about.
Yep, that was good.
There's also some that don't have Wikipedia pages. Even I have confidence. The hymn from the beginning.
That one slapped.
The Lonely Goat Herd, when they're... Is that what they're singing when they're in the boat? Something Good?
That one was written for the movie.
Okay. And So Long Farewell is good.
So Long Farewell. Yeah, that one's good too.
Yeah, I actually like that one. I'd put that one up there.
Yeah. Imagine you were at a party and like the host brought out his 7 kids and they sang that to you.
And the one's like crawling up the stairs because she's like pretending to be so tired.
I don't think any of our kids, our friends are going to have 7 kids.
I don't know. We'll see. So far, we're at max 1.
1. 2.
2 for us.
Yeah.
Oh, and actually, no. We just had kids who, friends who had their second baby.
So, yeah, we'll see. We'll let you know in 10 years when we got a Von Trapp crew.
Yeah. So then, like, there's the Baroness and Max.
Yeah, I kind of, all right, I especially like the Baroness in this.
The Baroness is like, oh, I wrote down, the Baroness is like Meredith Blake from The Parent Trap.
Literally. But she ends up having a good heart.
But she also was a little manipulative.
Oh, well, first of all, she was the reason why Julie Andrews left.
Like, she
did it on purpose.
She planted the seed.
Yeah. And she was like, oh, well, once this girl's out of the way,
He'll be all mine.
Yeah. And turns out he couldn't get this nun out of his head.
Turns out, shout out to our last week episode on Jurassic Park, life, finds a way.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Jeff Goldblum.
Then I just wrote, yep, Rolf is a Nazi. Yikes.
Yeah.
When he's like throwing the rocks at her window and he's wearing the uniform and, yep, and the captain catches him.
Well, that is something like, I know that one of the things about this movie that's kind of crazy is that it takes like a very like scary action turn.
It turns into like a thriller at the end.
Yeah. And a lot of it's based on the occupation of Austria by the Axis powers and of Germany, and because this happens right around World War II, so it's kind of crazy how it turns, tone wise. But
it's
the seeds
there.
Are there the whole
it's
time.
There. Well, this is the first little sequence where you get the captain kind of breaking his exterior, where he's like flirting with the Baroness, and then he sees Rolf. And he's like blasting Rolf for being a part of what he was a part of.
Mm-hmm.
And he then chastises Max because Max is like the Baroness's like friend or something.
Yeah, I don't know.
And he's with her and he's basically trying to turn them into like a family band.
Yeah.
He's
the Brian Epstein of.
Yes, yes. Brian Epstein.
Yeah, yes.
Of the Beatles.
Of the Beatles. The Beatles manager.
And he chastises him because Max is like, well, you know, it's going to happen or it's going to not. Like, we'll be fine. And the captain's like, no.
Right.
This is not going to happen to Austria.
Which is like, it's interesting that this movie, it was made like 2 decades after World War II ended. And so it is interesting to see the different sort of approaches of people's mindsets.
And let's be honest, it's very similar to what we've seen in the past decade or so.
Yep. For sure.
It's really interesting to see the people who are not willing to take a stand and the people who are.
Yeah, seriously.
And the people who are actively supporting a lot of the stuff going on, like Rolf. I did think that, especially coming off that scene, we have Maria and them on the boat.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like, okay, we're going back to the happy stuff.
Yep.
And they're like on the boat and then they see the captain at the dock or like at the house. So they pull and they like some of them fall out of the boat and whatever. And it's like a whole big thing. I thought that was a really funny way for Maria to meet the Baroness and sort of again, juxtapose the two of them.
Yeah.
And be like, okay, well, the Baroness isn't, like, evil, but she's, like, elegant and, yeah, like, gorgeous. Like, traditionally gorgeous. Okay. Not that Julie Andrews isn't, let's, I mean, be honest, yeah, here.
But she is very much more of a girl next door look.
Especially the way that the costume design is, where she's, yes, wearing... They make fun of her outfits, like, the whole movie.
Right. All right, Tom. Well, let's say we're playing the dating game here, and you're the captain, Captain Von Trapp. You're Georg. And you got your two options, Baroness and the governess.
Oh, man.
Who are you picking to go on your date?
I think there's got to be a little bit of context here. Like, knowing the Baroness's friends, like, I want nothing to do with those stuffy people, those stuffy rich people.
Well, she immediately is like, you're going to hold a party for me, right?
Yeah, yeah. Which kind of rules, actually.
She's kind of iconic.
I don't have a problem with her specifically because she seems fine.
She's fun. She's funny, actually.
She seems okay. But I think that I would get so sick of her friends. And I guess Maria's friends are like the nuns.
Yeah,
so.
they're nice.
Which are nice. I think that I like the Baroness. I think that she's fine. But I think that Maria.
It's a love connection there.
I think that she is nicer, more different, going to challenge her more.
Yeah.
In productive ways.
Yeah. And she's got a little spunk to her, too. She does. You know?
And it's not like she's annoying. She's not really. She's just earnest. She's very earnest.
Plus, there's something to be said for her really focusing on really liking his family.
Yeah.
And that's something that is important. If you have a family that the person that you're with gets along with them and actively enjoys being with them.
Yeah.
The Baroness tolerates the kids. There's a scene where she's trying to play a game with them.
Yeah.
But you could tell nobody's into it.
It's not her instinct. Whereas it's definitely...
Which,
Maria's
that's
instinct.
Okay, too.
Oh, yeah. Again, no issue with the Baroness.
But in this case...
Other than her slight manipulation of Maria. But
yes,
she's not terrible, is what I'm trying to say.
But I think that Georg seeing Maria and how she was with the children definitely helped his perception of her.
For sure. And she actually... Julie Andrews, during shooting, in order to kind of entertain all the kids, was singing Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Yeah, because she had just filmed...
It hadn't been released yet. They thought that she wrote the song... for them.
Iconic.
Imagine, like, that's like, and it's like one of the most famous songs in the history
of
movies.
Awesome.
And they thought it was like specifically for them.
Yeah, I love that.
So, you know, piggybacking off of that. Then
also, hold on. Do you know how to spell supercalifragilisticexpialidocious?
Go ahead.
I might get it wrong now. S U P E R C A L I F R A G I L I S T I C E X.
Keep going.
Wait, supercalifragilistic. X-P-A-L.
No.
I-D-O-D-I-C-I-O-U-S.
Very close. I'm not going to go through all of it again. But you were very close. You missed like the last...
A couple letters.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah. What did you think? So they go on and they do that puppet show.
Yeah, that was weird.
And it's like a yodeling scene.
Yeah.
Who made those puppets? Like, I know.
No, I do know. They
I
said
know
it
the
afterwards.
Real people. Oh,
no,
okay.
They said it afterwards. Max had, like, they said it was some
Max
guy.
Max is a puppet guy?
No, but he knew the puppet guy.
Oh, okay.
And they're like, can we keep these? So, like, meaning, like, they bought it or they rented it from this puppet guy.
Oh, okay. That's fair then. I missed that. Because the real people who made them were, like, the premier puppet people of the day. It was,
I mean,
like
they were really cool looking.
It was either, like, a husband and wife or, like, a brother and sister or something like that. But they were, like, the puppet people.
The puppet people.
The puppet people from the 60s. The other thing is, like, when did they have time to synchronize these dances? Like, the puppets are dancing at the same time.
Yeah, they do a good job.
They're moving around. Like, they only became, like, friends with her, like, 2 days ago.
Maybe they're just prodigies at puppets.
That's what they should have been doing the whole time. Forget about singing. Then the kids come out to say goodnight to everyone at, like, the party or whatever. Yeah. And they're parading them around like Oompa Loompas.
Yeah.
And they sing
So Long Farewell.
So Long Farewell. Then we kind of get more into the, like, there's a bunch of, like, pro-Nazi party people at the big party.
Yes.
And that is another scene where Christopher Plummer is like, they were like, oh, like, he wasn't being very nice to the Nazi guy.
And he also had the Austrian flag up.
He did.
Instead of the Nazi flag.
Didn't he tear apart the Nazi flag?
That was later.
Oh, that's later on. That
became a whole meme.
Oh, did it?
Oh, yeah.
I wrote, is there anything hotter than Christopher Plummer tearing apart
the
Nazi flag?
The answer is no. Like, totally not. That's a whole thing.
I didn't know that.
It is.
He calls out Rolf and then Max and then that guy at the, you know, the guy at the party, and they were like, oh, you sound like you're, he says something to him.
Oh, yeah.
And then he turns around and he goes, oh, I didn't mean to sound like that. I meant to accuse you.
Yeah. Where he said, oh, thanks for the compliment. He's like, no. I meant to accuse you. I was like, oh, Christopher Plummer.
He said, listen, shots fired.
Yeah.
Get at me.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, kind of the Baroness is sort of influencing Maria to go back to the convent. Because she danced with the captain at the party. And
oh, yeah, and
like,
that's where they felt, you could tell they were in love.
And the Baroness was like, uh-oh.
She's like, here, I want to live in this mansion. I just don't want to party. I want to live here.
Yes. But then we get like we're talking cinematography again, like a really great shot of her leaving through the front door that like mirrors when she came in. It's like the same setup, the same composition, and an empty hall, even though there's a party going on next door. It's like very... It's almost the exact reverse shot of when she comes in. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really, really awesome.
Oh, there's something else from the Baroness. Not in that scene necessarily, but that is definitely Meredith Blake from The Parent Trap.
Yeah.
Where Max asks her, what about the kids? And she's like, well, they do have boarding school.
Yeah. I gotta do like a side-by-side comparison of Meredith Blake and the Baroness from this movie. So then we get an intermission, which I did not expect.
Yeah, it was a long intermission too.
It was. We fast forwarded through it. You're like, all right, let's get this moving.
Had a lot of like reprises of the songs and stuff like that.
As you mentioned, we talked about this in the Killers of the Flower Moon episode. Did this movie do anything to change your opinion on that, or you think like sort of movie by movie basis?
For what? Long?
For intermissions. Long?
Oh, intermissions. I like an intermission if it's planned. And that's what I know Martin Scorsese
is the issue with Killers,
That there was no intermission planned. And I don't think it matters either way. I think that it's the choice of the filmmaker.
I think it helped in this one.
I think
it was a good choice.
And I think they had a really good
moment
to break.
That was when it happened.
Same with Gone with the Wind. They do the same thing. There's a really good moment where the movie almost feels like it's in two halves.
I've never seen
with the burning of Tara. It's like a whole thing, which is the house that she lived in. And so I really liked that here. But I also like Killers of the Flower Moon. I got to say, I was riveted throughout the whole movie. And there's not a point.
I don't think there's a logical spot.
To pause.
They said it's when, spoilers, skip ahead 5 seconds, when he gets arrested.
So here, totally fine. Killer's not doing it. Totally fine. Oppenheimer, there was no place to put an intermission.
That one I didn't think needed one whatsoever.
No. So I truly think it's on a case-by-case basis, and I am good with whatever the filmmaker chooses.
Yeah.
Because that's their vision.
Another thing, I agree. Moving on past that, we get... it's like the next morning or like a couple days later or something. And I thought that the costume design in this scene was so perfect.
Why?
So Maria's gone and the captain, he comes out dressed in black the next morning when it's him and the Baroness and she's playing games with them and all that. Yeah. All the kids are in like really muted colors too. That was like a moment where I was like, the technical aspects of this movie are so on point, which is something that I didn't expect. You know, like I thought it was just going to be a musical, whatever.
Fun musical.
Yeah. But like really, really well done filmmaking there.
That's beautiful.
On that note, is the captain a good dad?
I think that number one, at the beginning, he is trying, but it's hard. And so for him, he is relying on what he knows, which is being in charge of a military situation.
Right.
And so that's what he falls back on. Is it the best way to parent? My argument would be no. But is he trying? Yes.
But at the same time, he's also like, let me get a governess so I can go gallivant around with the Max and the Baroness at all of our fancy parties.
That's how the other half lives, let's be honest. The 1%.
True.
Like,
it is true.
It's a different way of living. I'm not going to judge it. And then later on, he becomes a great dad.
He grows into it for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Towards the end. But he needed the support, which he wasn't really getting in the beginning. And it was just like, all right, well, I can't be the one, or I at least don't want to be the one to be on the boat with them and singing all the songs. He's like, that's not me.
Yeah.
But.
And I think it's okay to, especially in the 40s when this took place, where the roles of a father versus a mother are much more defined and separate from one another.
Yeah.
And so if that's the case and you're looking at it from that lens, he very much ends up fitting into a great active parent role later on.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think he definitely grows into being a good dad. He's got the potential in the beginning, even though he's a little stern and sort of cut off, but I think that he learns his lesson. He's a good example of a dynamic character.
Yeah, and you can see that the kids really want to have that connection with him throughout the movie.
Yeah.
And Maria even tells him as much, which is cool for her to be able to say that to him and be like, you're kind of stinking it up right now.
Yeah.
And your kids will actually want to hang out with you, so why don't you try it?
Right. Climb Every Mountain. Banger.
Banger, always.
With Mother Abbess singing it to her. Great use of light and shadow in that scene, too, when they're in the convent.
And great throwback to the beginning of the movie when her being on that mountain was seen as a negative, and now she's telling her to do that.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
It's great. And I love when she's, like, singing from the shadows and, like, it's just Maria in the light and her in the darkness.
Yeah.
It's such a really, it's really, really well set. Again, the composition of a lot of these shots is really, really unbelievable. So then she goes back and they're in the same, they're singing in the same greenhouse area. It's the captain and Maria when she like
they're in the gazebo
when they reunite. It's exactly where Liesl and Rolf were earlier in the movie, but it's much more like chill and mature and romantic. That scene, when they were filming that scene, apparently like there was something to do with like she kept like blowing raspberries and when they like got really close together. And they kept laughing, and it took them, like, 20 takes.
We need the blooper reel.
We do need the blooper reel. And, like, Christopher Plummer was like, this was the most ridiculous scene to film because we couldn't... He's like, first of all, I can't dance and I can't sing. So I'm, like, just trying to hang with Julie Andrews.
Yeah, who's amazing.
And also, of course, he's dubbed over anyway. His voice is dubbed over, but by Billy, I think the guy's name was.
Disney guy.
Yeah. And he was like, she just kept blowing around and we couldn't stop laughing. So they like dimmed everything. So like the iconic shot of them standing together with like all in shadow is because they're like laughing.
Sometimes it's kismet.
Yeah. And you can like, he was like, you can kind of see it if you know and you're watching it.
Didn't notice it.
But he said that he really thought that that added a lot. The way that they ended up doing it added a lot. And he was like, I don't know how we got through that one take, but we got the one take and it's great. And there's actually a picture of it in the book too.
Beautiful.
Despite his, you know, general opinion on this movie. What were your thoughts on the wedding? How'd you think it looked?
Fine.
Yeah. I liked the, that she walked down the aisle to Maria.
Yeah.
The diss track.
That's kind of like really cool.
Oh man.
To take the diss track and to make it your wedding song.
Yeah.
That's kind of fire.
Yeah.
She's gangster. Maria's gangster.
So the Baroness is gone at this point.
Yeah, she went back to Vienna.
But Max is still here?
Yeah, he's his friend too for many years. They call him Uncle Max.
I know, but he's like, what are you doing here? He came here with the Baroness and like, is he just living here now?
He's like, I need to start this family band.
Yeah, well, he's trying to get them, like, he does that whole show at the end. So, okay, fine. But I thought that it was interesting because he's trying to get this show going and he's talking to the Nazi officials and they're like, letting the kids sing would actually be good because it would show that after they took over, Austria was fine.
Yeah.
Which is a really, like, terrible reason for them to allow this to go on.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, you get Edelweiss being the captain solo.
Yeah.
And he sort of gets choked up as he's looking out into the crowd and he sees his countrymen kind of like being visibly moved. And then he sees like the Nazi officers in the front row. And I thought that it was great because then the family sort of rescues him. You know, they chime in once he starts starting, his voice is starting to crack. That's probably my favorite moment in the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get the handful of Nazi clowns in the front row sort of experiencing this moment with the Austrians. Edelweiss was actually the last song that Oscar Hammerstein wrote before he died. And I saw recently that they put up, I think last year, they released like a box set or something that had Christopher Plummer's vocals for the song.
Yeah, I saw that.
Which is really cool. And then it literally turns into a thriller from there. Like, they're running away from the Nazis at that point. Like, they go out, and then they win the competition, and Max calls them back out, and no one comes out. Right. So they're trying to escape. The music, I love when there's attention to detail, because even though I do think the music gets a little repetitive and a lot of it kind of sounds similar, there are really cool overtures, like when they're being chased by the Nazis and there's like a panicked version of So Long Farewell playing in the background. It's such a cool way to sort of twist that song. And as they're hiding in the crypt in literally like the scariest moment of their lives, you get notes of My Favorite Things.
Yeah.
Which then the one daughter is like, can we sing it? Can we sing it? And she's like, no, like we're going to get caught if we sing it. Like we cannot sing that. So we have to suppress it for now, but we can think it, we can hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's how we're going to get through this horrifying moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole crypt scene, like they're hiding in the crypt and there's like all these, it's under the abbey or whatever. Yes. And I love the symbolism of that because like they're hiding there and it's like the Austrians who they lost are still helping their people get away from the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a really cool sort of
beautiful
symbolic and yeah, cool way to go about that.
And the nuns help too.
Yeah, the nuns do help. They steal the engine from the car or whatever. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not a car guy.
They mess up the cars so that the Nazis can't chase them.
And the captain absolutely alphas Rolf. So Rolf pulls the gun on him in the crypt.
Yeah.
And he just walks up to him and he's like, nah, dude, you're not going to shoot me. I'm taking this gun. And then he yells and he calls for the Nazis anyway. But
and Lisa's like, you're so not getting another date.
Yeah.
No, she didn't actually say that.
In the source play, apparently Rolf helps them.
Okay.
So
and in the real life, he didn't exist.
Oh, okay. I didn't know
him
that.
And Liesel were not real characters.
So apparently it's to fulfill his promise he made in 16 going on 17.
Mm.
But the screenwriter, Ernest Lehman, reworked this just because it's like, I don't think he wanted to be like, actually, the Nazis did something good.
Oh, he's actually good. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think he wanted to be like, no, this guy's irredeemable.
Which is fair.
Especially 20 years after.
I think that's a good choice.
I'm not saying any. Yeah, absolutely. I'm not saying that it would have been. I think it kind of would have been kind of cheesy if he just helped them out.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the idea that the captain just was like, nah, you're not. You don't have that dog in you.
Yeah.
I'm taking this gun from you and we're leaving.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Wait, I really like that because, you know, they could have done earlier the captain said that's not really who you are, and instead of it being like him, Rolf, this 17-year-old being like, you're right, it's not, let me help you, instead it's like, yeah, it's not really who you are because you're not even gonna do this.
Yeah.
And then that makes Christopher Plummer even more of a hero and Rolf even more of a loser.
And it goes to show like Rolf did not know what he was getting
into.
And there's probably thousands of those people who the Nazis indoctrinated into thinking that they are, you know, harder than they actually are for the horrible things that the Nazis did.
Mm-hmm. Really interesting choice.
Yeah. And then it's off to Switzerland, follow every rainbow, climb every mountain, et cetera, et cetera.
And they literally physically have to climb the mountain to escape.
Yeah.
Because the train stopped or whatever.
And then
they blocked off the roads.
It's cool. It's a cool bookend with the opening as well. That's The Sound of Music. The day after they left Austria in real life, it was by train to Italy. It wasn't trekking over the mountains. Allegedly, the day after Hitler ordered the borders of Austria to be shut. Mm-hmm. And then after they fled, their home was, and I think this actually is true. Like, I'm not just, like, I wouldn't say it if I didn't think it was true, but their home was apparently taken over by Heinrich Himmler.
Oh, really?
Who was one of the key players, obviously. I don't know exactly. Some of them, I don't know a lot of them, but, and Adolf Hitler, like, was there.
Wow.
Like, he went there a lot.
Wow.
And, as I mentioned, too, the movie was heavily censored in Germany. Virtually all of the Nazi overtones were taken out of it. Eventually, it was restored, but it never really scored any traction.
Interesting.
In Germany.
Wow.
I thought it was great.
Yeah. I really liked the movie. And I think that it is one of the best musicals out there.
Yeah.
Musical movies.
It's a classic.
It's a classic.
This is one I would categorize as not necessarily my thing, and I think it's too long, but I think it's a good movie.
For sure. So then my only two questions here, or I got three. I said, who gives the best performance? It's got to be Julie Andrews, right?
Julie Andrews. She's the heartbeat of the whole movie.
Exactly. What are your favorite and least favorite things about the movie? You like it. Tell me what you really liked and then what was less successful for you.
What are some of my favorite things about The Sound of Music? Julie Andrews is the number one. Like, she carries it. It's hard for me to watch a 3-hour movie and then, like, and stay enthused the whole time. And I thought that she was an excellent, she added a lot of, she was the kind of mirror by which the movie bounces off of.
Yeah.
And she makes you view everything else around the movie as good or bad or happy or sad or whatever type of emotion you're filtering through Maria.
Yeah.
Which I think is, and I think that she's the perfect like conduit for that.
I think that Julie Andrews also has a way of feeling both, like her performances feel very classic Hollywood, but still with a twist to it where it still feels modern. And I think that that's a really interesting thing that not a lot of actors have been able to do.
Yeah, I think Plummer was also great.
He's
especially
lovely.
With his like subtle changes throughout the movie. I thought he was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The acting was great. I mentioned the cinematography.
Yeah, gorgeous.
Cinematography, and not just like the nature cinematography, as mm-hmm. I talked about the use of shadows and all that, and the costume design even. Like
yep.
all that stuff I thought was really, really great and elevates this movie over a lot of musicals that I've seen.
Mm-hmm. What about things you didn't like as much? Too dang long, too many kids.
Too dang long, too many kids. That's pretty much it, really.
Yeah.
I don't really have any. I don't mind the tonal shift at the end. I
think either.
I think there are hints throughout
that make it make sense.
And we know what the time period is. We know where we're at in the world. Yeah. I think it would have maybe been... Maybe you don't need to do it in a thrillery, like, escape kind of way, but we know the challenges facing these people.
Right, and it was a desperate situation.
And it would have been possibly disingenuous to not include something like
true.
That.
True, yeah.
Especially given the fact that the family did actually escape.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
It's not, like, the part at the end where they're getting chased, like, maybe didn't happen exactly that way, but for all intents and purposes, it did.
Right.
So, as far as we know. So, I have no problem with it.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah. My final question, why do you think this movie was, I mean, we know why it was popular. It's a great movie. Why was it so dang popular? Like, one of the top movies of all time popular.
I honestly don't know. Like, it's a great movie. And it's, people I think were more accustomed to long movies back then. So it's not like, it's a 3-hour movie now. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Oppenheimer made a billion.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that there's just something about the, like a magnetic, good versus evil, musical about family. Like, it hits kind of everything that uh-huh. is a crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
You know? And it's got, you know, good looking, talented actors and actresses. It's the two leads.
Mm-hmm.
She was coming off Mary Poppins, so people were probably like, oh my God, what's she going to do next? She was a megastar at the time, coming off of Mary Poppins. So that's probably a part of it. The fact that it has all of these incredible crew members, Robert Wise, Lehman, the editor was up for a bunch of stuff. Like, it's Rodgers and Hammerstein. The musical, I'm sure, was extremely popular. And I don't know how many musicals had been converted into movies yet.
Yeah, I don't know.
By this point, I mean, I'm sure there probably were a
West Side
lot.
Story.
But yeah, but I think it's probably a confluence of all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that people probably were already listening to the music from it.
Yeah.
You know, from the musical. So there was a lot of that sort of built into it.
Yeah.
And then you get people who go see it and you're like, this is like an incredibly beautiful movie.
And it did like, it was popular. I think it hit number one in its fourth week of release.
It probably was a thing like that where it was just a sort of perfect storm of everything around it that sort of made it into a smash hit.
I also think that it's a simple story.
It is.
And so I think that there's something to be said for that, where it's a simple story that's compelling and has the other bells and whistles with the music and the performances and the key players that are well-known. But at its core, it's a very simple family story. And I think that that's something that people can relate to.
And we hadn't run the Nazi stories into the ground yet.
No.
Like we did through the 70s and 80s.
Right. Which, again, important.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about like Indiana Jones.
Yeah. Right,
you know, it just became like, oh, the Nazis are the bad guys now.
Right.
Oh, that reminds me. My Breaking Bad theory is it fits this movie. Where in Breaking Bad, like in the later seasons when Walter White is like reprehensible beyond compare, like, the way to get you to sort of come back on his side and root for him as the antihero was to introduce a guy with a swastika on his neck.
Yeah.
And he's like the villain. Like the Nazis are like automatically the villain, like period. Yes. And rightfully so.
Yeah.
And in this one, this is exactly what happens with the captain. Cause you get the captain who is like
he's kind of mean.
He's kind of mean. And like, he's the only person in this movie that's really puts a damper on anything besides like the couple of nuns who we meet in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you sort of crack his shell? You put the Nazis on the other end of him.
Yeah.
And now he's able to sort of wriggle free and become someone who is an honorable person mm-hmm. and is good to the kids and is good with Maria. Yep. This totally fits my Breaking Bad theory.
There you go.
So if you if you're writing something and you want your character is not a good person and you want them to appear to be a good person, just put the Nazis on the other side.
Yep.
Yeah. So I think that's a good spot to wrap it up.
All right.
Thank you for listening to our Sound of Music episode, and stay tuned for our announcement. It's going to come either Wednesday or Thursday, so this is going to come out Tuesday. Please stay tuned. Please follow us on social media, because we're going to have a lot more to come regarding our announcement. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so next month we're going to be doing Anyone But You.
Yeah.
Ma for Mother's Day.
Woo!
Then we're going to be doing Toy Story 2 to sort of come full circle from our first episode as we yep. near our 100th. Mm-hmm. And we're going to do Swingers with Uncle Robbie, who was around way back in our Shining episode.
Vegas, baby.
And then the first week of June, because it's going to be our 100th episode, we're going to just announce it now. It's going to be one of our favorites of all time. Pop star, Never Stop, Never Stopping.
Top three all time.
Not three.
Not three.
Top two, not two.
It's the best movie.
No, it's one of our favorites. We hope you will watch those, or you've seen them and you like them. And if you don't like them, listen anyway. So we will see you next week for Anyone But You.
Okay, goodbye.
See you later.